Feinstein to be here. One shit, just to hear what I can do with his material.
Rav Avadya knows me, so I'm okay. All right, today is December 18th, 2011, and I want to say hello to everyone here, and hello to everyone listening, and by all the comments I'm getting, I see that the shurim go up right away, and I already have comments on last week's shayurim, which I'll relate to in a second. We finished that last week, a major area, inter-ethnic marriages, and what do we do, husband and wife, the differences. And last week we saw a very fascinating material that Moshe Feinstein, with the shaitel, the woman, the husband is worried. People think if she wears a shaitel, she's not covering her hair. It's her real hair. It must be an expensive shaitel. These must be elegant people. I would imagine survivors. I'm only guessing survivors of the Holocaust. And he made a little money in New York, and his wife can afford a nice shaitel. And in addition, Rav Moshe tells him, "Well, and you shave your face and you're not worried, everyone will think you're shaving with a razor, so don't be machmir on your wife's back." It's a fascinating shuvah. Then we saw Rav David Halevi and Rav Chaim David Halevi, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. And there you see a sensitivity that comes with modernity. He was very, very different. And you see it in all this shuvat. And there, you see, he reaches the conclusion that if it doesn't bother the husband, the woman can continue her practices. There's no need to make her take on kulot, which her father didn't have, and where she would feel a little anguish eating rice on Pesach, etc., etc. And he says, why should it trouble the husband? But what's interesting about the shuvah is that it's a Yemenite girl marrying a Baal Tshuva. And whose minig do you take on? And here he says, later when the husband becomes frum, the children should follow the husband. So we discussed it in class. And I'll tell you, halacha lemaisa, it all depends on the circumstances. But I've gotten this she'ela many times. And I personally, mi anochi, but nevertheless, I can have an opinion. I paskin differently than Rav Halevi. Very simply, that if you're a Moroccan and your whole Yiddishkeit comes from Litvashi Yeshivat, there's nothing wrong if you feel you want to follow your Rebbe, because your Rebbe, to a certain degree, becomes the substitute for your father. But it's a delicate question, and as I said, Rav Shach, his Talmidim, Sfadim Tahorim, they think like Rav Shach 100%. They're all in Agudat Yisrael, or Rav Shach afterwards sent them to Shas, and they read Naflisik in Yiddish. And nevertheless, Rav Shach was Makpid, they should live with Eidat HaMizrach Minhagim. Now, I just want to tell you, a Talmid corrected me. I mentioned Nitzchia Halevi, the chief rabbi's daughter, who was my student. So she lives in Neve Daniel. I said Mitzpah Yericho. But what's interesting is she's married to a very big Talmud Chacham, Harav Shlomo Levi, a very similar name, who's the Rosh Kolel in Yeshivat Har Etzion. So it's fascinating. And finally, last week we finished off with a puzzle, a jigsaw puzzle, how a husband and wife can be in one room, and one is observing Yantif and one is not observing Yantif, and that, of course, is what I showed you from Yantif Sheni Kehilchata. And again, if you ask me, that shaila would never come up, because I go with the Rav Shita that it depends where your feet are in relation to Yantif Sheni. Now, I just want to mention, and Yitzchak, this is for you, and anyone else who wants a copy of, I made a few copies. This is the Divrei Torah Phil Chinovsky, which I quoted last week, and I've gotten reaction from all over the world that people were blown away by his Divrei Torah. So after class, if anyone wants, there are a few more copies here. In relating to the Sheitel and Rav Avadya, So I got a very interesting email from my Talmid in London, Rabbi Yisrael Phillips. And without going into all the detail, his wife, his daughter married into an Eidah Mizrach family. I believe their origins in Iran, if I'm correct, right? And it's a large family, 11 children. And he describes that most of the women do not wear shetels. But his daughter, even though she's married to a Sfadi, his Rav gave her permission to wear a partial shetel. And one of the sisters from the Iranian family is married to a rabbi from Edinburgh, and she already wears a regular shetel. So you see that at times the Sfadic Rabbanim will give in to a little bit Ashkenazic pressure, at least partway, a partial shetel. And in relation to a question that we discussed a few weeks ago, my Talmud Rabbi Moshe Elbaum, who's a graduate of the Kollel and has been in Chinuch now for over 20 years, So he said that he heard, you know, we spoke about being Makabel Shabbos early if your wife has to follow you. So I told him, Yerushalayim, everyone, I've never yet seen anyone paskin that the wife does not have to follow the husband. But Rab Mordechai Tendler told him what I said and what I quoted, the Tshuva Reb Moshe, that Reb Moshe said the wife does not have to be Makabel Shabbat early. And of course the question is why, and he goes into a thought here that today when people in Makabel Shabbat early, like in a bungalow colony, he's describing the country, they're doing out of convenience, not Tosfat Shabbat. And therefore, perhaps if the man wants to do it out of convenience, it doesn't obligate the wife. I have to tell you, my own way of thinking is different, because you may do it out of convenience, but nevertheless, the whole concept of being Makabel Shabbos early is based upon Tosefet Shabbat. And once it's Tosefet Shabbat, it's very hard for me to envision two kehilat in one house. In other words, all our lamdonot was based upon, all our lamdas, let me speak proper yeshiva Yinglish, all our lamdas is based upon the fact that today we have Sfadim, Ashkenazim, subdivisions and subdivisions, and everyone lives next to each other, but we're all different communities. But in one house, a husband and wife, to say the man is Makabel Shabbos and the wife is first putting up the challenge, I have my hesitancies. Nevertheless, Reb Moshe Paskin, Wadi Paskin, and Mi Lani Yoteh Gadol Mei Reb Moshe Feinstein. Finally, and I'll have to ask Yitzchak, can you play video yet? A video, right?
Yes.
Can you play this yet? So I'm giving you, do you have Casablan with Yehoram Gaon? Pass that back to Yitzchak. I pass it on. I don't need it back because
I.
Do you have a DVD? I don't have it.
It can be transferred.
No, it's not worth. I recorded it from.
Right.
I just want to explain to the class how it fits in here. But I just want to tell you, I recorded it from the movies, from the TV, maybe 20 plus years ago. So you have to, you have to skip over. They interrupt with news, with this, with that, with advertisements, you'll see. But the whole film is there. And you see, Casablanca, forget about Casablanca. Casablanca, those of you know, was one of the most famous American films made with Humphrey Bogart, World War II, the start of World War II, and it gives you courage to believe in the resistance, the Nazis will fall. Forget about that. Casablanca, which is the same word, basically. Casablanca, White House. It's about Tel Aviv in the early 70s, and it stars Yehoram Gaon. That's the famous Yehoram Gaon, one of the most famous singers in Israel, who's a Moroccan by origins, but he and his late brother owned the state of Israel, if you understand what I'm saying. His brother was the head of Kur. I mean, you're Moroccan. So at that time, everyone had the feeling a Moroccan, you know, it's the second Israel, the third Israel. And the film, the main plot in the film is Yehoram Gaon falls in love with an Ashkenazic girl. She's a daughter of the Pelish's survivors, and the family is furious, you know, the interethnic marriage, what's happening. And finally, the funniest scene in the whole movie, which captures what we're talking about on a very light level, but it captures it nevertheless, is her parents invite him for Shabbos dinner, and they serve gefilte fish with horseradish. And he doesn't know what the horseradish is. He takes a big portion, and, you know, he burns his mouth. The gefilte fish he feeds to the, what was it, the dog or the cat that's under the, you know, the film that's under the chair. And I started to cry. Somebody says, what are you crying? I said, because it reminds me of an unbelievable story the Rav told. I believe I wrote this up in the Rav Volume 1, that the Shagat Rabbi Leib of Metz, the great Rabbi Leib, the Shagat Aryeh, was so poor that when he was elected Rabbi of Metz, he was coming to a community, you know, that was part of France already, and there was a little bit money there, and they had Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov. They had the Rebbetzin make a kiddush to welcome everyone to our house. So the Balabatim brought her coffee and sugar. So she didn't know that you put the sugar into the coffee. And the Rebbe told the story that everyone had bitter coffee, and afterwards she served the sugar. It's written up, I have word by word from the Rebbe. So that's why I was crying. I said to my wife, that story with the horseradish reminded me of the Rav story about the Rabbi Leib, the Shagat Aryeh, Echad Megedoli Gedoli Yisrael, and how poor they were. And that story at Casablanca is exactly the problem of inter-ethnic marriages. It has a happy ending, the boy gets the girl, and it ends off very appropriately for us, because we have a Brit Mila tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning class begins at 10. There's a Brit Mila. I'm ending from 11:25. I am 10 to 11:25 because we have a Brit Mila of Baruch Hashem in the Kollel, one of our most popular students. So you'll hear me. If I get a chance to speak, you'll understand my Divrei Torah. So that captures the inter-ethnic marriage. And the Brit tomorrow is the way the film ends. It's an inter-ethnic Brit, just as tomorrow is an inter-ethnic Brit. So it all ties in. Okay, gentlemen, thank you for bearing with me. I'm now ready to begin. And I want to touch upon a very delicate question and express an opinion. After 53 years of teaching Torah, I'm brave enough and I would say boisterous enough to express an opinion. Teaching youngsters Gemara is a problem in America, it's a problem here. You know, when a kid starts learning, particularly in the modern day and age where we're so utilitarian and so pragmatic, kid goes to high school, he has to pass exams, he goes to college, he has a major, and suddenly you introduce a kid to Gemara, and the Ribbono Shel Olam, he's learning Baba Batri, he's learning Yevamot, he's learning Kedushin. He may occasionally look into Makot Sanhedrin. And you know, he's overwhelmed and he's caught up, and what do we call it? The Yam HaTalmud. It's like you threw him into the waters and he's swimming and he's passing all types of reefs and coral growths and all types of different bolts. And you know, people say, well, why don't we give an introduction? Why don't we try to organize it? Why don't we try to make sense out of it? We're starting to teach a kid at the age of 10 Gemara. Why don't we tell him what it's about? And you see, here you have a very delicate problem, because until he swims in the sea, he won't understand an introduction. And generally speaking, by the time he has swam a few years, no one thinks of doing an introduction, or no one is simply capable of doing an introduction, because all of us are swimming and we're swimming together. And that's the way I started studying Talmud, and you started studying Talmud, and why do we need modern technology? So I have to tell you, there's a lot of truth to it, and my own, I'll just say in parentheses, my own feeling is that the traditional way of teaching Talmud is the best way. Let a kid start swimming, let him start sinking a little, let him start gasping for air, let him learn how to come up, how to be a deep sea diver. But at a certain point, perhaps it's important to give a class, what is it all about? And I want to mention a few names, because the shun I'm beginning now, and this is this year and next year and the year afterwards, etc., I'm very much in debt to people who were not my rebbeim face to face, but were my rebbeim vis-a-vis their teachings, vis-a-vis their books. And if you know the Achronim, they have a din of a Rebbe as well. And here, of course, above all, I want to mention Reb Shlomo Yosef Zevin. I don't think, if you're familiar with all his writings, and he was a very prolific author, everyone knows Ishim V'Shitat, everyone knows Mo'adim B'Halacha, everyone knows Halacha La'or Halacha, but there are another three volumes of Sofrim V'Sfarim, where he has magnificent essays that he published over the course of decades. When you put it all together, and then with the Talmudic Encyclopedia, he teaches you how to organize, how to see, how to think, how to really give an introduction to Sifrut HaPoskim, Sifrut Chazal. I also want to mention, of course, Professor Menachem Alon. Professor Menachem Alon, he's an old man today, he's a sick man. I'm happy to tell you that he was one of my earliest acquaintances when I came in Aliyah in 69. He lives around the corner. BMT began on Rehov Ababinel 24. The building stands. Rakefet has no power. I have no one behind me. YU doesn't even acknowledge that I'm on their faculty. It's beyond words. I'm embarrassed because people call me and they say, aren't you on the faculty? They just gave a list. Someone asked me, do you get a salary? Someone from Chicago asked me, do you get a salary? I say, I get, so you can call it a salary, fine. So I have no one behind me. So I have all these wonderful ideas, but no one's listening. No one cares. In this world, you have an institution, you have money, it speaks. Rakefet walks. A plaque should be put up on the building on Rehov Ababinel. In this building, the history of Torah and the Anglo-Jewish world was changed. 1969, BMT began its first classes here. Go and dream. When I started teaching in BMT, 10 students, that was the first class. I can give you some of the names, not all of them are alive. And who would dream what came out of it? So, around the corner, Ibn Shaprut, literally a half block from BMT, I think it's 12 or 10, Ibn Shaprut, is where Professor Alon lived. And he davened in BMT, that's how I got to know him. And he occasionally, when he was free, would come into my classes on Sunday. I remember, if he was free, he would come in, he wanted to hear a Talmud of the Rav. See, there were no Talmudim of the Rav, really, in Eretz Yisrael at the time. And he wanted to hear a Talmud of the Rav. He would come in and listen. And Professor Alon, he's a Chevron Yeshiva graduate. So to quote Rakefet, Chevron Yeshiva cannot boast about its graduates. Who are their famous graduates? Professor Alon, Chaim Herzog, President of the State of Israel, General Herzog, Reb Shlomo Gorin, Chief Rabbi of the Israeli Defense Forces, and you go by one, the Chevron Yeshiva graduates. Today Chevron says, Apikorsim, Zionistim, what happened? But Professor Alon, the man's knowledge, Shasim Paiskim, but it's not only that. He went to Hebrew U, law. Then he was, of course, the assistant head judge of the Supreme Court. His classic work is Mishpat Ivri, three volumes in Hebrew. I don't know what it is. It was translated into English. Four volumes in English, you say. I tell you, you should master those volumes. It opens up your eyes. It is, and not only that, he deals with Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh, Moshe, as a divine imperative. But he puts it into the language of contemporary jurisprudence. And I don't know anyone else who did it as well as Professor Menachem Alon. So I want to acknowledge him as a Rebbe. The third and final Rebbe who helped me immensely was a great individual, Nebuch, the price we pay to be able to sit here. Professor Rabbi Dr. Avraham Chaim Freiman, Hashem Yikom Damo. He was a graduate of, I believe, of Hildesheimers. He was from Germany. He was, if I'm not mistaken, you can check it out, an ainikel of the Orech Laner, Reb Yaakov Ettlinger. I know members of the family, one of his, a niece of his, is married to Labriot, who you should all know the name, Professor Richard Steiner of Bernard Rebbe Graduate School. His brother is married to a niece of Professor Avram Chaim Freiman. They live in, he's a professor at Hebrew U. These are all brilliant people. These are people who, you know, a guy like me, who's a normal guy, it's very hard for me to walk on the same territory with these geniuses. So Professor Freiman knew everything. He was a graduate of Hildesheimer. He was professor of rabbinic literature at Hebrew U. His specialty was responsa literature. He issued Shelut Tshuvot HaRambam. He was the first one. Now, of course, we have the Professor Blau edition, which we all use. But before Blau, Professor Freiman's edition, and he had many articles, and the man's ability to put it all together was second to none. He was killed on the convoy, the Ayin Chet, I believe it is called. They were going up to Har HaTzofim. It was after a ceasefire. I think it was 49. You can check it out. 48, 49, 47. It was going up. The UN was supervising it, and the British were supervising. It has to be checked. And you say the British?
The British soldiers were on the side watching the whole thing.
And didn't do a thing.
Yimach
Shmam B'Zichram. And they wiped out the entire convoy, basically, among them world-famous medical doctors, nurses going up to Har HaTzofim, where there was the hospital, where there was the library, and he was going to take Sfarim out of the library in Har HaTzofim. And he lost his life, and terrible. And I recall his memory, Hashem Yikom Damo Zecher Tzadik Livracha. So let me begin. Gentlemen, you're going to be rabbis, you're going to be balabatim, it doesn't matter, you have to paskin a shayla, you have to know, where do we find the sources for the Var Hashem Zu Halacha? So let me mention four major categories, and I owe these concepts to Rav Zevin more than anyone. Number one, and I'll explain each one in great detail, but for the sake of an organized lecture series. Number one, Mefarshim, commentaries on the Gemara. You all know that learning Shas, learning Torah Shabbat Peh, that's where you have your basic raw material for how we live as Jews, how we paskin a halacha, what we do. Number two, we have Poskim. Not just the Gemara with the Mefarshim, but we have people, Gedolei Yisrael, who wrote codes of Jewish law. And these are poskim to whom we turn whenever we have a Sheila and we have to get involved with the halachic process and we have to give an answer. Number three, we have meshivim, responsa literature. These are not poskim. These are rabbanim throughout the millennium who dealt with she'elot, halacha l'maaseh, how to give answers, how to give guidance, put together a responsum, and it circulated. There might have been arguments, there might have been controversy, but these are perhaps the most fascinating volumes of Torah Shebaal Peh because it's life before our eyes, as you have seen in this very class. And then finally, a new terminology, and I'll explain everything in great detail, but not everything today. A new terminology that was coined after the Holocaust. We have Mesadrim. Seder. What does a Seder mean? Leil Pesach Netaneh, we have a Seder. Kadesh, Urachatz, why is it called a Seder? It's organized. It's not haplap. every other Friday night, every other Yontif, you can sing this song, you can sing that song, you can say Divrei Torah, you can learn Mishnayot, you can do whatever you want. But Leil HaSeder, it's organized. There's a format. Mesadrim took the whole corpus of rabbinic literature and attempted to organize it. And you fellas sitting here are the greatest beneficiaries of the Mesadrim. Talmudic Encyclopedia, Otsa HaPoskim, Torah Shlema, to a certain degree the Bar Ilan Response to Literature Computer Project. And we'll come back to this. So, when you talk about Paskin in a Shaila, I have to answer a question. What do I look at? What do I have to know? What is rabbinic literature? Four major areas. Mefarshim, Poskim, Meshivim, Misadrim. Alright? And now, let's talk about the Mefarshim. There are three different types of Mefarshim. Again, we're borrowing terminology, we're using rubrics that Chazal used, you know, in different areas, but we're borrowing it and we're turning it into terminology for this lecture. One type of Mefarsh, and every word I will explain, Mehaprat al Haklal. A second type, Mehaklal al Haprat. A third type, Mechadshin u'mefalpalim. Alright, what am I talking about? The Rav said in public many times, and remember, the Rav comes from Beit Brisk. The Rav is a Soloveitchik. The Rav is an Einikel. I apologize, I sound like a Chabadnik here, Yutet Kislev. I'm using present tense. But you have to understand, for me, my Rebbe is a very real presence in this classroom and in my life. So I can only use present tense. The Rav comes from a world that everyone praised and extolled the Rambam. When we went into class, Rabbi Rubin will verify what I'm saying is correct. We brought two Sfarim into class, a Gemara and a Rambam. I still have today a little set of Gemara and a little set of Rambam. It's in my closet, in my room, in my office. I traveled when I came in Aliyah. That was on the boat. On the boat, that was with me in my hand luggage, as if to speak. My set of Shas, my set of Rambam, and the Rav said, I quote, yes, everyone knows that I'm a big fan of the Rambam. Everyone knows how important the Rambam is, but I have a secret for you. Without Rashi, we would not be able to learn Gemara. He is infinitely more important than the Rambam, quote, end quote. And of course, when we talk about Mefarshim, the first word that comes to mind is Reb Shlomo Yitzchaki, Rashi. Without Rashi, how do we open up a Gemara? How do we open up a Gemara? And even today, with Baruch Hashem Steinsaltz, and Schuttenstein, as my grandchildren say, it all goes back to Rashi. Rashi paved the way. Wow. But Rashi is very interesting. How does Rashi explain everything? Prat goes line by line in the Gemara. Whatever, there's a difficult word, a difficult concept, he will explain it. I need not tell you Rashi's greatness when you compare on the Masechta, or part of the Masechta, that Rashi did not write a Perush on, and his grandchildren whoever it's attributed to, and a lot has been written from the point of view of scholarship. A lot has been written on Rashi, you know, on those Masechtot where he suddenly it says Rashi died right here. You see how many lines the Rashbam needed. What Rashi could do in 5 lines, it took the Rashbam 15, 20 lines. So Rashi, what an ability, what a, he's called the Pashandana, he's called the Meferesh par excellence. What an ability. But he never gave you an overlook, right or wrong, never gave you an introduction, never summarized basically what he was doing. He went from the prat, but ultimately, when you put all the little pratim together, you master the Gemara and you have the klal. His perish is the pratim, but ultimately, it leads you to feel, oh, I mastered Masechet Sanhedrin. I understand every word. I mastered Makot. I mastered Brachot. I can put it all together. I can understand. And remember, it's a difficult language. Look at Rashi, how many times he resorts to French words, right or wrong. Gemara, go look at Rakefet's volume, I believe it's it may be volume 2 on the Rub. Look at Rakefet's Washington Avenue. I describe what it's. I quote the Rub there. You notice in my in Washington, I quote the Rub. I quote from my work on the Rub to show you how it fits into life, how to utilize it. And the Rub makes the point that there's nothing harder for a kid to start learning Gemara. It's a strange language, not just for kids in Boston, not just for kids in New York, kids in Poland, kids in Israel. When I started teaching in Michala, I used to think, gee, these Israeli girls must be so brilliant. They grew up in Hebrew. And then I saw they grew up in Hebrew. But the greatest part of Torah Shabbat Kher is written in Aramaic / Hebrew, a very unique but a very different language. And thanks to Rashi, we can master a Daf Gemara. And look at the Steinsaltz. Steinsaltz simply takes Rashi and makes it intelligible in modern Hebrew. And Schottenstein, many times what Schottenstein is doing, where Rashi used the word in French, so Schottenstein uses English. And I need not tell you how much has been written on the French words in Rashi, how much has been published on Old French, and what we learned from Rashi, and how we reconstruct language, but there's no greater example. Perhaps the only example we have, Mecha Pratel HaKlal. This is Rashi, and the Rashbam, those that filled in the Perushim, where Rashi did not complete it. By the way, I want to just mention in parentheses, because we're living at a time of Professor Paula Hyman died on Friday, I believe. I don't think you recognize the name, but I know the family, and she was very big at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and a pious woman, but a real thrust for feminism and everything that Rivadeh believes in, to use Rabbi Shimshon Sherer's term, the cold word. And we're living at a time, you know, where the feminist, the thrust is on. So I want to tell you in parentheses, you should know that Rashi's daughters helped edit the Perush. You all know they were Lamda Niyot, and tradition has it they put on tefillin. All right, does it mean they actually put on tefillin, or they were on a level where they could have put on tefillin? But Rashi's daughters were really something. And in modern times, I can tell you, you've heard the name Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, the Slabotka, Eitz Chaim Resh Yeshiva, Rabbaran Kutler's father-in-law, grandfather-in-law of Rabbi Yehuda Ramital, Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. So you should know his Rebbetzin edited his writings, copied his writings, the Evan HaEzel, look into the introduction. His Rebbetzin, I believe her name was Bella Hinda, she was on the level. that she could correct and help, and these were great women. So when you mention Rashi and the Rashbam and the great family, and you and about and you speak about Rashi, so let me mention his daughters as well. We don't have to be conservative Jews to respect and give credence to the feminine mystique, and among them women lamdaniyot muvhakot. Okay. Now let me go a step further and come to something very fascinating. And I'll repeat a story which I haven't said in years, but I want to put it into context. Then you have Perushim Mehaklal El Haprat. Now what does that mean? Tell me, how many of you are familiar with Perush HaRambam L'Mishnayot? Have you ever dealt with it? What do you notice about the Perush HaRambam? Yes, Mendel? He always gives you an introduction, an overlook, before he gives you the klal. An organized student, students today would love that approach. Before they start swimming, he gives you a... By the way, the coming Rabbi Rosenzweig is like this in his shirim. Anyone hear a Talmud of Rabbi Rosenzweig? Anyone in the Kollel? They tell me Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig, who's married to my Talmidas, the Professor Smada Eliach Rosenzweig. I better give titles. I have to respect these people. So Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig, I'm told, gives introductions that can take a week, 2 weeks. He's very... Am I right? Am I right?
Months even.
Okay, thank God. But the Rambam is a classic example. Ah, now let me go one step further. Mehaklal el haprat. In other words, and afterwards, he goes into what's mentioned in the Mishnah and gives you much more details and prepares you for the sugya. But originally, he opens up with an overlook, a general introduction. Gentlemen, let me tell you two stories. We never had a Meiri. When I learned in Volozhin 150 years ago, the Meiri did not exist. When I learned in Mir in Poland and Slobodka in White Russia, Lithuania, Tells, the Meiri did not exist. 1930s already, there were rumors that their manuscripts, and after World War II, a march began redeeming the manuscripts. Some were held in the Vatican, Italian libraries, other libraries. The Meiri. And you all know, editions started coming out. First, the Meiri just published plain, then edited editions. Perhaps, if I have the first name correct, I think it was Avraham Sofer, but you can check it out and correct me if I'm wrong, a great-great-great-great-grandson of the Chatam Sofer, who left Israel to teach at Jewish Theological Seminary and devoted all his extra time outside of the few hours he taught to editing the Meiri. And I'm learning Baba Batra with the... my Rebbe, right before I went up to the Rav Shir of Shmuel Eliezer Volk and Atelja, victim of Hitler, I don't have to tell you, ran away from Europe, and Israel, and had he been in Europe, he would have been carried on his students' hands, but came to America, a greenhorn, with all that implies. And I saved my lunch money, and if you ever looked at the original edition of the Meiri on Baba Batra, it's a big, thick volume. I believe I gave it to my son-in-law Chaim. Big, thick volume. And $10 it cost. That was a fortune. And I brought it to class, and Rav Volk exploded. I quoted something from the Meiri. Mir nicht geguckt in am Ehrigen Tellchen, ich werd nicht jetzt gucken in am Ehrigen, wo hast du de Geld? Zentaler für am Ehrigen? Translation. We didn't look at a Meirian Tells, and I'm not going to look at a Meiri now. How do you get $10 to waste? on a sefer that to Rav Volk was unimportant. Tell me. I'll come back to Rav Volk's attitude in a few minutes. Why did we love the Meiri? Why did we jump on the Meiri? And even today, when you read essays about people who are rebelling the way Gemara is taught and are demanding that it should be taught differently and more attractively, you'll inevitably see, why don't we use the Meiri? Because the Meiri, even more than the Rambam, Mei HaKlal El HaPrat, begins with the Mishnah, with a long introduction, gives you the whole sugya, the klalim, what you're going to try to do, what you're going to approach, what you're trying to derive, and then he goes prat by prat by prat, infinitely more than the Rambam, covering the whole Gemara. But there's always that introduction. There's always the klal. From the klal, you come to the prat. Students loved it. And the reason is very simple. We are products of Torah and the Western world. I need not tell you my divrei Torah from the Rav, Yevet Toshav and Achim. We live in two worlds. So Rav Chaim, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik used to boast that if not for Rav Chaim, no modern kid would study Gemara. Rav Chaim gave it svarah, gave it depth, like a chemistry insight, like a biological insight. So I go one step further. You know how we love the Meiri? Because you always loved the class in college where there was a good introduction. And you knew what you were getting into. You knew what you were studying. You knew what you had to look for. Where there was a good summary. The Meiri is like that. The modern kid who's going to Yeshiva College, at least in my days, I don't know Yeshiva College today after the Beacon article and all that's going on. I don't know, La'an ani holech, I don't know where I belong, but that doesn't matter now. I'm living the past right now. Oh, did we love the Meiri. And that, and the Rambam, Perish HaMishnayot, a classic example of Mei HaKlal El HaPrat. You with me, Shmuel? Okay. Now, tell me. I told you a little story about Shmuel Eliezer Volk. He was a very interesting character, a tremendous Talmud Chacham, but you always felt the Hitler tragedy in his presence because you saw the struggle of his acculturation to the Yeshiva University scene. Tell me, this attitude towards a new sefer, can you comprehend it, or do you want to dismiss it outright? Yaakov, let me tell you another story. And this story, until today, I meet people who lived it, who still are thinking about it. Michlala, occasionally I had much older women sitting in my class. One of the women who studied with me for many, many, many years, they've written about her, she just turned 90, she's a very elegant woman, Shulamit Katan. Recognize the name? She was the librarian of the Knesset. Her life story is fascinating. She married her husband, the late Moshe Katan, who wrote a book on, they were French, and he wrote a book on the French words in Rashi, Moshe Katan. If I recall everything correctly, Dr. Moshe Katan, I believe she has a doctorate. And they married when the Vichy government was running France, Yimach Shmam V'Zichram, and people laughed at them. What are you getting married now? We have no future. We'll all be killed. Today, Alat Mata Kodesh, there are hundreds and hundreds of direct descendants of this couple. You will meet them all over. Rashi Yeshiva, with some of the medical doctors in Shaarei Tzedek, are women. They are children, grandchildren of very brilliant family. And as she said, everyone in the family is Shomer Torah Mitzvah. But I think that they're Haredim in the family, Chadalim, Tzuniyim Datiyim, Modern Orthodox. She was just interviewed in Makor Rishon a few weeks ago. I read a beautiful article and a picture. You couldn't believe how many descendants are standing around her. So she was the librarian, and you can imagine this was a woman that kept on absorbing knowledge. This is a woman who never stood still. I hope I'm like that, Be'ezrat Hashem. You know I'm always looking for something new. So one time in class, and you can hear this on a recording, it was the mid-70s, and it was the Yahre Kallah in Boston. Do you know what the Yahre Kallah were? The Yahre Kallah is very simple. After the Rav's wife died in 67, it was a tremendous trauma for Rebbe. And Kol Zman, he could teach Torah in New York, he was alive. He came back to Boston for the summer. It was terrible. A lady, Mrs. Feuerstein, what's her first name? It's Mo Feuerstein's widow. Great lady. Elegant lady. What a skut she has. She arranged, I believe, beginning with 68, that some of the best of the yeshiva students from New York should come up to Boston for the summer to learn with the Rav. And he said, sure, on the Maimonides campus, sometimes out in the lawn, depending on the weather, every day, and they would be with him for like 8 weeks during the summer. By 69, the elder students, the rabbis complained, Lamani Gara, Pesach Sheni. So RCA began a Yahre Kallah. I have the exact dates in my book. I think it's 69. Yahre Kallah, they came up Monday. I had shiur Monday afternoon, Tuesday morning and night, Wednesday morning, or maybe it began Tuesday through Thursday, and they were back to their communities. In 75, I believe it was, the first volume of the Frankel edition came out. Seder Moed, if you're Zmanim, if you recall. Why Zmanim? Because that's most widely learned, and I guess that's where they began. It would be the most interesting, like Steinsaltz began his translation, the first two volumes to appear with Sanhedrin, because Rabbi Avner Steinsaltz wanted to have influence on the Israeli courts that they should introduce Mishpat Ivri, and for that you must begin with Sanhedrin. So they began with Seder Zrayim. The Rav is giving Shurim they began with Seder Moed, and the Rav was giving Shayurim and Seder Zmanim. I think the Rambam, I'm calling it Moed like the Mishnah, but I think the Rambam calls it Zmanim in Mishnah Torah. And the Rav was giving Shurim and those in Yonim, and suddenly he asked for Rambam. The Rav didn't come this year with Xeroxes like I'm coming. This is a modern version. We wasted 20% of every shiur, guys running back and forth to the library in the second floor to bring the Rav a Gemara, to bring the Rav a Rambam, to bring the Rav a Sefer, to bring this, that. So the Rav says, does somebody have a Rambam, Hilchat Shabbos? And they pass up a Rambam to the Rav, and it's a Frankel Rambam. And you can hear the tape, the Rav opens it. Oh, name, Chenisht, I can't. I'm not familiar with this Rambam. I need a Vasheva Rambam. And they run him back and get him a Vasheva. What he means is the original Rambam, that type was set, was called the Vasheva, was printed originally in Warsaw, the one that we all used as kids. And they sent up the Vasheva Rambam, and the Rav says, I apologize, but this is the Rambam I'm used to. I want to tell you, I told the story in class, and Shulamit Katan, Dr. Katan, was flabbergasted. She couldn't get over it. I met her years later. She said to me, how could the Rav not look at Frankel at the new work? It's so much better. But you see, you become used to something. It's like you can read a book on the computer. I can't. I just can't. They walk, I saw in the subways in New York, I still ride the subways, Baruch Hashem, I'm so much, I'm with Meisha, that I can be a normal human being. I don't have to go on subways with separate seating. Oh God, what we're up against here. Shem Yirachim Aleinu. The Chil Hashem, it's beyond words that this is what the government is meeting about today. That happened Friday, that woman became a hero, instant hero. I mean, a normal woman, that's all. So I see them, what do they call these little books today where they, what do you call it?
Kindle.
What does Kindle mean? Where did they get that word, Kindle? How can you read a book on a Kindle? What, am I crazy? This is a book. And thus to Shabbos, what am I going to do Shabbos? See, I don't criticize the Rav. I don't criticize Rav Volk. I understand their mindset. I'm proud to say that I can look at a Frankel Rambam and I don't need a Vasheva Rambam. I understand. I understand the Rav. But I don't want to criticize Rav Volk. But he wouldn't look at a Meiri. And we loved the Meiri because it was Me HaKlal El HaPrat. Yes, Yitzchak.
Now, going back to lectures that you gave about the Kozomis, you can find the book. Commentary or...
Yeah, no, we're going to deal with that.
What do you do if you develop a whole parish of the Gemara, you give a whole shiur, a whole time of the paper that you never saw, like you said, the Meiri. And he explained it so well and so clearly that everything you said was wrong.
Correct. So if that's the case, you have to say that we've now discovered a Meiri, and like the Rav, you know what happened with the Rav. The story is a legendary. You know, this guy... he asked the Rav a question, he's giving a whole pilpul, and the Rav, you know, in our times, which loses temper, and let me speak in Amoritz, don't talk like an Amoritz, and shut the guy down. And then the Rav, 2 hours later, is looking for the guy who is eating lunch in the Greasy Spoon across the street, and the Rav walks into the Greasy Spoon, he finally found him, and he goes over to him, and he apologizes, and he says, "You were right, and I was wrong, and tomorrow I'll revise my whole shiur because of what you said." And that happened many times. But I'll ask the question a lot stronger. What do you do if you paskin the certain way, and the Shulchan Aruch paskin the certain way, and the Ramar, and the Shach, and the Taz, and the Magen Avram, and then you find the Meiri that's totally different? Sikresha, Dolomichalei, Mormekil, with so much inference on halacha, automatic elevators, etc. What do you do? It's a legitimate question. I'll deal with it down the line. Not today.
That only the conservative movement introduces these things, and that we have closed our minds.
No, no, Chas v'Chalila, there's a world of literature on this topic. But we will get to it. Today I just want to, put down in today's lecture and next week, 2 weeks, by the way, next week is Hanukkah. So there's no Shiurim. Sunday, Monday, the Kollel is off Hanukkah, and then we pick up afterwards. Also, God should be kind to me, my mother is very ill, and I'm on a day-to-day basis, let's put it that way. She's in Herzog now, and I just spoke with my brother before class. I said to my brother, to my eyes, I don't see how she's alive. I don't understand it. Now, my brother's a doctor. He says, look, the vital signs are good, and, you know, she's hooked up. The Ribbono Shel Olam should have mercy and do what's best. Yehudit Bas Peset Zippa. I don't know if she recognized me this morning. Her eyes were open, but she didn't speak to me. And yet when the nurse... the doctor told me, tell the nurse to clean the eyes, there's like mucus. She said, don't do anything. I couldn't believe it. And clear, I could understand her. And my brother told me he had the same thing on Shabbos. Exactly the same thing. Those were the only words he heard her say. So anyway, all things being equal, Be'ezrat Hashem, Maisim Nisim, and all the credit to the Israeli hospitals, Shaarei Tzedek, Herzog. They didn't say you're 98 years old. They treated my mother like she was 18. And I want to stress this. I stressed it last Monday in class with Divrei Torah, and I stress it here. Okay. Now, but then there's a third type of peirush. Mechadshim u'mefalpelim. What does it mean? They already have unique insights. They already call in various Gemaras, go back and forth. The overwhelming majority of Rishonim Amachadshim u'mafalpolim. Tosfot. The Ramban. The Rashba. The Ritba. The Tosfot Rash. You can go on and on. In every Masechet you find Rishonim, manuscripts, what comes up. And wow, they are very different than Rashi. Very different than the Meiri, Abriyut. Very different than Perush HaRambam, LeMishnah. Oh, they don't comment on everything. Did you ever see Rashi say, this sugya doesn't interest me? This sugya I'm not interested in commenting on. Tosfot, let's talk about Tosfot. You know very well that Tosfot only comments on what he has something unique to say, something unique to add, a chiddush, a pilpul, a contradiction. Occasionally he'll throw in a psak halacha. He'll tell you Rabbeinu Tam, what Rabbeinu Tam did, what the Reed did. But the best description of Tosfot is kulo chiddush v'pilpul. And where he's interested, where he wants to comment. And you know, because of the nature of Tosfot's comments, Tosfot can be 10, 20, 30 times the length of Rashi on the same line in the Gemara. I needn't go further than Cheskat HaBatim. Take a look at some of the Tosfot there. In general, you see yourself, you can have a Amudim of Gemara where you have 20 lines of Rashi and 60 lines in Tosfot. And yet Rashi comments on everything. Tosfot, Ramban, Ritba, Rashba, Shita Mekubetzet, Tosfot HaRosh, whatever Sefer you mention among the Rishonim, where they have a chat, where they have a new insight, where they think they've caught a contradiction, that's where they comment. Who is longer? Has anyone ever counted how many words there are in Rashi and Shas, and how many words there are in Tosfot? It's a very interesting question. Logically speaking, you would say Rashi is longer. He comments on everything. You're absolutely right. But Tosfot can equal Rashi because where he does comment, endless more sentences, words, insights, contradictions, psak halacha in Tosfot. The end result may be they're pretty equal. Rashi, meha, prat al haklal, but he covers 90% of the lines in Shas. Tosfot may only allude to 30% of the lines in Shas. But when he alludes, it is endless. So it's an interesting question. And now you can understand why Rashi is always studied before Tosfot. When you start giving a shiur, you have to be a half-wit to go to Tosfot before Rashi. Rashi is the basis. Rashi explains the Gemara. Rashi gives us the depth to appreciate Tosfot. Ah, once you have the Gemara mastered, once you have the Rashi mastered, and it could be Bizman Hazel when you want to look into a Meiri, Perish Mishnayit L'Rambam, then you go to Tosfot, you go to Rishonim, L'Hagdil Torah L'Hadira. What a different, beautiful world. Okay. These are the Mefarshim. three different types. Mechaprat al haklal, haklal al haprat, mechadshim umefalpelim. Now we're arriving. Why do we have poskim? What happened here? Who heard of poskim? The Gemara, let's go with Toshe B'Chtav first, the Chumash. You have everything mixed together. History, revelation, theology, laws. You sort it out. You figure it out. All right, Torah Shabbat Peh ultimately was written down. The original plan was Torah Shabbat Peh should not be written down. You all recall the shiur I gave years ago on what the original concept was and why Torah Shabbat Peh was not written down. In one word, Eitz Chaim Hi. It's a living tradition. Torah cannot be gained from a moribund book. To be a Ben Torah, you have to have a Rebbe. Even today, even if after it was written down in such an esoteric fashion that you must have a Rebbe. Without a Rebbe, it doesn't get off the floor. You can be a nice Jew, but wow, will you make mistakes in lifestyle, in hashkafa, in outlook, in dedication, in mesirat nefesh. Must have a Rebbe. We are, I'm a Litvak, so I have one, you have a Rebbe. In a Litvak, I always say, a Rebbe, you have only one Rebbe. Inevitably, when the Talmud is young, the Rebbe is old. When the Talmud is old, the Rebbe is gone. I'm a Litvak. Those of you that are Chassidim, you're fortunate. A Chassid always has a Rebbe. When the Chassid is young, the Rebbe is old. When the Chassid is old, the Rebbe is young. But it's a sight to see. I always tell you, in 1966, when this 18-year-old kid wet behind the ears, married the Mishnah Rebbe's daughter, and Ziknei Bells, who knew Shas and Paiskim by heart, backwards and forwards, who never sinned in their lives, who survived the Holocaust with miracles, stood before this 18-year-old kid with a cup in their hands, halachayim, at that moment, he became Bells Rebbe. And 80-year-old people deferred to him. That's a chassid. Yaakov, I can't be a chassid. I can explain it, but I'm a litvak. But you must have a Rebbe. So they finally wrote down the Gemara. All right, the Gemara, it's a challenge. Everything is in there. Agada, halacha, history, theology, philosophy, blessings, curse words, unbelievable stories, insights, man, woman, good, bad, good. Wow, everything is in Shas. Nothing is missing. It's beyond words what you can find in Shas. So what happened suddenly? 9th century, 10th century, 11th century, 12th, everything. Poskim, codes. What happened? All right, this is a tremendous question. There are probably... And I say probably because these are theories, but these are theories that make sense. There are probably two tremendous reasons why the Jews began to develop codification literature. One reason is very, very simple. Until the 7th, 8th century, 8th, 9th century, we all lived near each other. The Jews lived in Palestine. They lived in Babylonia. That was it. There was constant social intercourse between these countries. You know from the Gemara, Rabbi Zeir went up here, this one goes back and forth. There are entire volumes written on the traffic between Bavel to Eretz Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. Taya Sugyas and Shas. Who's more important? Anan Kafin and Lei, we're subject to them. The Rosh Gola, Galuta, the Nasi. By the end of the Gonic period, a great diaspora is beginning. And the Jews are winding up in Spain, Franco-Germany, Morocco, Algiers, tremendous colors. And the focal center is weakened. Who do we turn to? That's what happened when the Jews came to America. Jews came to America, no rabbanim, no yeshiva, no one to turn. Ish hayasha be'enav ya'aseh. In this big gullus, finally, they started to write svarim. Look, we know you're living far from us. We know you don't have that much time to learn. We know that you're involved in a process of acculturation with your new society. We know that you have to make a living. We're going to give you a guidebook that's going to teach you A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Do as the guidebook says and you will be a good Jew. And in those years, religion was the center of life. Everyone wanted to be a good Jew. It's not like America, where they arrived in America, you have to make a living. The heck with the old country. Yeah, they wanted. And we start to have guidebooks that code, that continue to enhance, to paint, to give you content to Torah life into this very second. And a year doesn't go by today that a new guidebook is not written. On Shabbos, on Chol HaMoed, on Muktzah, on Yom Tov Sheni, you have on every topic imaginable. On the rabbinate, it had to be a rabbi, the halacha pertaining to the rabbinate, for Rabbi Leventhal put out a beautiful volume here. It's an amazing world today. So that's one reason. The dispersion of the Jews is why they began codification literature. By the way, in parentheses, you should know that the Chafetz Chaim reached out to the Jews in America. And he wrote, to the best of my knowledge, it's the only Gadol Shebegdolim who wrote an entire volume just for the Jews in America. It means America, Canada, or England, but knew what volume I'm referring to. Nitchei Yisrael. It's a volume written telling them what Kashrut is, what Shabbat is, what Taret Mishpacha is, what you can compromise, what you can't compromise. The Chafetz Chaim, in his love for all Jews, wrote a fabulous volume. I cite it in the Silva era. I quote the end of the volume. It's fascinating what the Chafetz Chaim wrote at the end. But that's cold literature. When you're close to home, when you have a Rebbe, when you have someone to watch, you don't need codes. A chassid essentially doesn't need codes. Goes to the Rebbe's tich, he watches the Rebbe, he sneaks behind the Rebbe. When the Lubavitcher Rebbe walked from his home on President Street to 770 Eastern Parkway, kids would hide behind cars to see the Rebbe go by. There was Yirat HaKovet, Hadrat HaKovet. No one wanted to go near to the Rebbe. He walked with a gabbai at times, without a gabbai, with two gabbaiim, and people would hide behind cars to watch them. Look, that's a chassid.
I did that with the Rebbe. Yeah. I used to walk like a general.
Right.
Right.
And where did you hide?
On St. Nicholas.
On St. Nicholas Avenue. I remember walking the Rebbe to the subway, talking about Adlai Stevenson running against Eisenhower. And I remember Rebbe's comment. This has to be 56, I would say.
After. He was going from the yeshiva to the door.
No, so this, he was walking to the subway. And we were walking with him. I was a kid. I don't even know if I was in a shiur yet. But the guy, and they were asking, Rebbe, what's your opinion? And the Rebbe said, Stevenson is, you can talk with him. He's intellectual. He has knowledge. But he'll never be elected because the masses go for a general. And Eisenhower can, you know, he never read a book, they say, about Eisenhower. But he will be elected for Kachave. Gentlemen, there may be a second reason why we needed codification literature. And could very well be the second reason is really the prime reason. What happened towards the end of the Gaonic period? For the first time after the Talmud, we had a tremendous schism. The Karaim broke away from the rabbinic leadership. The Karaites, they were the heirs of the Sadducees, of the Tzdukim, of the Gemara. You should understand that from time immemorial, Jews have rebelled against Torah Tashem Tamima, particularly the Torah Shebaal Peh, particularly the rabbis. This is nothing new. There's nothing new. We have rebellions today. We had rebellions at the time of the Talmud, and the Karaim, if you're familiar with Rabbeinu Sajigon and his battles with the Karaites, Karaim, only Masha Yesh B'Mikra, only that counts. And the Karaites were at one time a major force. And they were having influence on the corpus body of the Jewish people, and it may very well be because they were dispersed. And because they didn't have rabbis, they looked at the Karaites. And you know the way the Karaites lived on Shabbat? They had no lights on, no electricity, no lamp, nothing, no hot food. They didn't go out of their homes. There were all different traditions. This is a whole world of scholarship, by the way, that Rabbi Rebbe got his doctorate on, and even Rabbi Belkin in his doctorate deals with it as well. And they had a whole different lifestyle. Karaim, Lashon Mikra. And you needed a code of law to knock them out of the box, to tell the Jews, this is what you do, this is what you don't do, this is the way we live. Don't be fooled by the Karaim. We have our own lifestyle. And this may account for why the literature of the poskim developed now. Okay, now I want to give, we're not going to finish today, this is of course extremely fascinating and real to you because you've all experienced it, but I want to begin at the beginning. Perhaps the first volume that we can call a forerunner or a precursor or an overture or a nascent example of halachic psak literature is the She'iltot. The She'iltot of Rab Achaim Mishapcha, first half of the 8th century. Okay? That's what we're dealing with. Now, the She'iltot is very fascinating. I'll give you a little information on it, but let me explain it. What does the word She'iltot mean? She'iltot in Aramaic means a question. Questions. This word, the She'iltot, became so popular that let me teach you modern Hebrew. When you ask a question in class, Ich frage Shaila, ani shoel She'ila. Ah, in the Knesset, one of the 120 Knesset members ask a question. You don't want to call that a Shayla. You follow me, Michael? A Shayla is what Michael, the wise man, asks Aaron Rakefet. But in the Knesset, that's not dignified enough. Can anyone tell me what a question is called in the Knesset? She'ilta. Ingeniously, when they took up this problem, they borrowed the word from rabbinic literature. And you will hear it time and time again, Moshe. They wrap it out. She'ilta nishala b'Knesset. You understand me, Daniel? Dignity. This is not just the question that Shmuel is asking in Rambam Mitifta in Lawrence. This is Knesset Yisrael. And he's asking a she'ilta. Now, why is it called she'ilta? She'iltot. Are you familiar with this work? Let me explain. By the way, Tosfot quotes the She'iltot. There are a few places where you will see it quoted in Tosfot. It's later emendations, or it's later Balei Tosfot. It's discussed by Professor Orbach in his classic work, Balei Tosfot, which no one has equaled until today. And I can tell you, Professor Orbach lived around the corner from me. He never missed a minyan in Yad Tamar. He used to walk up the hill to Yad Tamar. That was his shul. Ephraim Elimelech Orbach, the Rav Yet knew him from Germany. It's on the Parshat of the Week. And every Parsha, every She'ilta begins with a question or questions. No? Why? Why? Why the questions? So I'll tell you what the theory is, and it's probably true. And we know this from responsa literature. In Babylonia, people went into dispersion, left Israel, left Babylonia, went to many other countries. They had to work hard. The first thing an immigrant has to do is work hard. Without money, you can get nowhere. And all of you know the story of the immigrant generation in America. 90% of their life was devoted to making a living to put bread and milk on the table. I don't even want to say butter. You can live without butter, but you do need bread and milk. No, when you work hard, you're too exhausted to learn. I see my grandsons get home from the army or Shabbos, whatever, and I try to cajole, come over, we'll learn a little. Ah, Shabbos, I'm too exhausted, I have to sleep. All right, I understand. So the only time they could study would be on Shabbat. No, when would they study on Shabbat? They would study after Musaf, after lunch, before Mincha. No, what do we eat on Shabbat? We Jews, you know, a guy like me who doesn't eat that much cholin, they would call me a Karaite. You look, what, you don't eat well on Shabbat, and cholin, and kugel, and a little herring, and a schnapps. No, here you are attending a shayur, and boy, the first thing that happens, your eyes close. I was at a shul in Lido Beach. The rabbi gets up to speak, and you should see the crowd there during the summer. The minute, and there, you know, they come from shuls where they have the biggest rabbis in the world, Rabbi Lukstein and Rabbi whatever's doing in Rabbi Riskin's shul, etc., etc. And here, and the first thing, they go to sleep. You know what burns me up? The minute the rabbi finishes, they wake up. When they once wanted me to speak there, I let them have it. I said, I don't mind if you go to sleep. But it bothers me that the minute the rabbi finishes, your eyes open and you are awake. Gentlemen, the tactic that the Gaonim used was to start the shir with questions. The minute you start the shir with questions, the people are attracted. They're interested. They're listening. What's the answer? And the rabbi goes on and on. He gives a big pulpul and he gives musa. And then the Rebbe, you asked 5 questions an hour and a half ago. What are the answers? Oh, yeah, yes, the question. Answer 1, answer 2, answer 3, answer 4, answer 5. That's psak halacha. It's mamish psak halacha lemaisa. And that's the theory. We can't be sure. But that's the theory. And I studied with the greatest expert in the world on the Shiltot. If I don't mention him today, I'll mention him next week. And that was his theory. And I know as a teacher. Remember, I'm teaching you fellas. You great individuals, fellas, all right? Some of you are younger than I am, what can I say? But I taught collegiate level. I taught in BMT. I taught in this building. I taught ruffians, gangsters, gamblers, drinkers, drug couriers. And I had to inspire them. And Baruch Hashem, Moshe, you can check my record. No one fell asleep in my class. Got it? This is the Shiltan. Ask a question. Gentlemen, Yeah, talk about the Beacon article. Remember what I said to you? That the Rosh Yeshiva should use this as a jumping stone to speak about Kedusha, about marriage, about holiness, about sex, and what sex is about, and the way the Ribbono Shel Olam built the world, and what's the difference between us, and Ma Beni Levein HaShifcha, and the way we act and live. Gentlemen, tell me, a boy met a girl from Machon Gold Saturday night at Richie's Pizzas. They didn't want to talk about the center of town, Richie's. And the boy told her a terrific Shabbat Torah that he heard that Shabbat in BMT from Reb Meisha Horowitz, the dean. And the girl wants to shake his hand and give him a yashikoyach. Is he allowed to take that girl's hand? That's the way you begin a class. Then you go into Kedusha and Tara and the Sugyan Kedushin and the Shulchan Aruch Eben Ezra and the Rambam and Hilchot Yisurei Bia. And then the kid an hour and a half later, Rebbe, what's the answer to the question? What question? Oh, the question, oh, about the boy and the girl. I'll tell you next week. Don't forget to come back. Got it, Ephraim? So that may be why they called it Shilchot. Now, Let me just go one step further.
Another thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
He had a son who was not on a high level, and in order to win him over, he started this way.
Okay, so what you just said and what I said are basically the same.
Oh, yeah,
except that Rev Shmuel Kalman Mirsky said he would bring proofs from the Gaonic literature of Mitzvah Gaonim. I'm familiar with this material, where you see they were dead tired Shabbos. And in order to keep the audience alert with his son and the rest of the audience, he woke them up with the questions. But what's important for you to understand, that we find psak halacha here. We find psak. Mamish 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Look into a shilt, you'll understand. Now, how did he tie the shilta together? So you see, I give you an example. It's like Rav Asher Weiss. Rav Asher Weiss will speak on the Pasha of the week, every week when he gives a shiur, or he publishes, he has a whole quartet around him that publishes. He's a fabulous individual. Really, we can really be proud that we have someone like Rav Asher Weiss. You understand, he speaks in Hebrew and Yiddish and English, and he's broad. He's a Kloisenberg Chassid, but he can address a Mizrahi group and a Gudda group. He can address everyone, a Hasidish group, a Litvish group. He's fabulous. So what do you mean you speak in the Parsha of the week? So you find one concept in the Parsha and you'll develop a whole theme on it. So you take Parshat Noach. I quote to you a sentence from Noach, Bereshit Vav Pasuk Yud Gimel. Keitz Kol Basar Balafanai Kimalah Haaretz Chamas Mipneihem. So on that Parsha, the Shilta deals with all the laws of theft and robbery. Follow? Hamas. What does Hamas mean? Geneva, Gezela, Hamas. And that's the way he hangs his Torah. He finds a peg in the Pasha. You take Pasha Vayetse, where you deal with Yaakov Avinu taking care of the sheep, the cattle of Lavan, that's where he deals with the whole concept of shomrim, of becoming a shomer for someone, a shomer sacher, a shomer chinam, a shoel, a socher, sugya shleimat mishas. But he ties it in with Pashat Vayetse.
That's exactly what Asher Weiss does.
I'm telling you, that's what I used to miss an example. Absolutely. Okay, listen, I know Rabbi Asher Weiss. I listen to him. I only wonder if he doesn't listen to some of the YU, because sometimes I hear, I once gave an unbelievable shiur which I worked on and discovered and developed and sources dealing with the Holocaust, with the Kovner Rebbe's psak about handing list over to the Nazis. And I heard Rabbi Asher Weiss, the same sources, the same what mahalach I had. So either we're both stealing from a third party, we're stealing from each other, or two minds work the same way. I believe it's the latter. But anyway, he's fabulous, Rav Asher Weiss. That's all I can tell you. And let me give you one more example. Parshat Miketz. What are you talking about, Miketz? This very week's Parsha, where Yehuda wants to guarantee Binyamin's return. Nu? Arevut. The whole concept of surety. The whole concept of being a guarantor. The whole concept of Arevut. The whole concept when you get married, you write Tanoim. Those of you that got married today already, we stopped writing Tanoim. It's a farce because Tanoim were written half year before, 2 months before. But the night of the wedding to write Tanoim, but right, some people do. What did you do, Ephraim? You wrote Tanoim the night of the wedding. So you need an Erev Kablon. They have to guarantee from her side, from your side. Most rabbis today don't even know what Tanoim are about. I've seen great rabbis and they get so flustered with Tanoim. You have to know what you're doing with Tanoim, and you have to have an easy one, not with an Erev Kablon, with this and that. That's where you're writing Tanoim 3 years before the wedding and you want to be sure the guy doesn't run away. You follow? The girl doesn't get lost. Gentlemen, this is our first example of Psak literature, the She'iltot. Very fascinating. And next week or next time we meet Be'ezrat Hashem, I will fill you in on two different volumes of the She'iltot and wherein they're different, the pros, the cons, and both volumes are very much part of the saga of Yeshiva University. So let me reiterate. We started today a new topic that's going to last for many years. The Ribbono Shel Olam, she gives strength. I cannot tell you what I'm preparing. And my wife said, what are you singing? What are you so happy? Ah, Baruch Hashem, I'm uncovering diamonds. And you should know, I did these lectures in a very primitive fashion maybe 25, 30 years ago, I don't even know. But they're totally different today. It's a total different level. And I modeh l'Kadosh Baruch Hu, you know, I'm not a youngster, and the Ebishter should give me strength and health and keep me active even longer than my mother was active. I shouldn't be like my father. Ribbono Shel Olam, are you listening? Like my mother, not my father. People always say to me, my mother, such genes. My mother was really totally active until 3 years ago. And I say, but I also had a father. Don't forget that. So what did we do today? We began an introduction. We dealt with Mefarshim. We're now starting Poskim. We dealt with three different types of Mefarshim. Prat al haklal, klal al haprat, mechadshim, mefalpolim, and all that went with it. Why Psak? We gave two major reasons. I don't think there are any other reasons given. One has to do what's called the modern Hebrew, Pizur Ha'uma HaYisraelit. We call it in English the diaspora. The great diaspora is beginning. Number two, it dealt with the Karayim, Keneged the Karayim, the Karaites, presented a tremendous problem for Rabbinic Judaism. They had to fight them many different ways. But one of the most important outcomes was that we had basic books of Dvar Halakha. Okay. Gentlemen, let us go step by step. Tomorrow we begin at 10 o'clock. There's a Brit. We will end at 11:25. I asked Rabbi Bednash to begin at 25 to 12 instead of 11:30, so you'll have a 10-minute break. I'll cut down the lecture at 11:20. Danny, remind me to keep my big mouth shut. Okay? Tomorrow's lecture is extremely important. The lectures I'm giving on Monday are very, very timely. Mamish halacha l'maisa at this very, very moment. Friday night I was invited out with Gedolei Ha'am HaYehudi, and they asked me, some very elegant people asked me the very questions what we're talking about in Shia. Now, I'm continuing, what do we do with the matzav in Israel? And then I'm going, what do we do? How do we relate to it? And then I'm going into a question that only a fool asks. But the answer I will propose, I'll tell you in advance, I have to go to mikveh before I give the answer. B'kedusha v'tara, why was our generation privileged? Why is Yitzchak Rubin sitting in Yerushalayim Mir HaKodesh learning Torah? Why did Ani Rothkopf, along with 20,000 other people, daven at the Kotel this Friday night? Where are we any better than our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents? Lama Zachinu. Okay. Now, we don't meet again then for Hanukkah. Yitzchak, let me give out a few freebies. This is Rav Asher Weiss. If anyone's interested, you know there's a big debate going on between Moshe Meiselman and Larry Kaplan. Yeah. This is Larry Kaplan's response. Please give me that. Okay. This is all in Hebrew. This is the set on Parshat HaShavua by Rav Menachem Ben Yaakov. I have a special love for him. He's a Panovich Talmud Chacham who became a Merkaz Harav devotee. We did basic training together in 1978, and he taught my daughter when she was learning to be the first female rabbinic. It's hours and hours. And this is Kirev Rechokim, Shabbos Kodesh, Kafschut. This is excellent. Have you done Adam LaKafschut? This is Kirev Rechokim. Some of it doesn't turn me on. It's too simplistic, but it's interesting what they're trying to do. And this is from Hamavaseh. There's a beautiful article in here on Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, having done it, Tol Adam LeKafschut. It's beautiful, beautiful article. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya.